No, I'd like to tell you about some work I've been doing over the last year with them in collaboration with Costa Skinner, and it's appeared in these papers here. The upshot is we're trying to apply holography to understand cosmology. So first of all, the notion of holography really kicked off. You can trace it back to these early papers by Ed Hoft in 1993, and it originally arose in the context of black hole physics. Why is the entropy of a black hole proportional to the area of the horizon rather than the volume? So in short, the holographic principle states that any quantum theory of gravity should have a dual description in terms of a quantum field theory without gravity that lives in one dimension less. And holography, basically, there was a precise formulation of holography was found within string theory about 10 years ago, you know, the famous ADS-CFT correspondence. So a big thrust of research in string theory over the last 10 years has been holographic dualities in string theory. So the point is that the holographic dualities that we've got concrete realizations of in string theory so far, these all involve spacetimes with a negative cosmological constant. However, the general arguments in favor of holography appear to apply more widely, and in particular, holography should apply to the evolution of our own universe. So this is something I'd like to tell you about today, how we should set up a holographic framework that enables us to study cosmology. And I'm going to focus on inflationary cosmology. So specifically, what we're going to try and do is we're going to try and construct a dual description of four-dimensional inflating universes in terms of a quantum field theory that lives in three dimensions without gravity. So first of all, let's think about what sort of ingredients any holographic framework for cosmology should have. So there are a number of ingredients any duality should have. So first of all, you've got to tell me precisely what is the quantum field theory that's dual to cosmology. Secondly, you have to give me a recipe. You have to tell me how to compute cosmological observables, such as the primordial power spectra, in terms of correlation functions of the dual quantum field theory. So let's say you've gone and set up such a duality between cosmology and holography. So first of all, you have to recover the standard inflationary predictions in the regime where the gravity description is weakly coupled, where the usual perturbative quantization fluctuations apply. So this corresponds to when the dual quantum field theory is strongly coupled. So basically, here we meet a key characteristic feature of holographic dualities. They're strong, weak coupling dualities. You have these two descriptions, the gravity description and you have the quantum field theory description. Now, when one description is strongly coupled, the other description is weakly coupled, and vice versa. So in a sense, the whole point of holographic dualities, from my perspective, is that you can understand the strongly coupled regime by going to the dual theory, which is in the weakly coupled regime. So I think we should do this for cosmology. So the point is, let's look at the regime where gravity is strongly coupled at early times. Now, this regime is described by the dual quantum field theory at weak coupling. So in particular, we can compute all our cosmological observables by using three-dimensional quantum field theory at weak coupling. So I'm going to show you later how we can actually set this up precisely, how we can make predictions, and how these predictions compare with the data. So the plan of the talk is as follows. So the first part, it splits naturally into two parts. The first part is describing holography for cosmology. This is our framework, which I've got a little cartoon of here. So in a nutshell, standard holography is the top line here. Standard holography maps spacetimes with negative curvature, for example, asymptotically ADS spacetimes, onto quantum field theories. Now, I'd like to apply holography to cosmology, which, you know, inflationary cosmologies have positive curvature, so we need to do some kind of analytic continuation to take us between these, what are called domain wall spacetimes, to cosmological spacetimes. So there's a particular set of analytic continuation of gravitational variables that will take us from these domain wall spacetimes to cosmological spacetimes. So the left-hand side of this diagram describes bulk gravitational physics. The right-hand side of the diagram describes the dual quantum field theory. So your standard holographic duality is the top line here. It maps a domain wall spacetime onto this quantum field theory. We're going to see how the analytic continuation of bulk gravitational variables translates into a corresponding continuation of quantum field theory variables. And that takes us from this quantum field theory to this new thing, which we're going to call a pseudo-quantum field theory. And then this is dual to cosmology. So this is a rough outline, and my plan for the first part of the talk is to talk you around this square point by point. And then in the second part of the talk, we're going to understand what happens when we try and do cosmology in this new regime where gravity is strongly coupled at early times.
So when you say pseudo-quantum, you mean Euclidean?
No, I don't, no. So you will see later on precisely how I define this pseudo-QFT. It's done by computing correlators in the usual QFT and applying a particular analytic continuation. It's not quite the same as Lorentz. It's not a weak rotation between Lorentzian and Euclidean. We'll see later what it is. Okay, so holography for cosmology. Let's start off just with a brief overview of how we do standard inflationary cosmology. Of course, you all know this. I just want to set variables and to put it in a slightly different form that's going to be useful for us later. So for simplicity, let's just consider four-dimensional single-field inflationary models with the action shown. We're going to assume a spatially flat background and perturb in the usual manner. And as you all know, the only physical propagating degrees of freedom are the transverse traceless tensor modes, gamma ij, and there's a single scalar, gauge invariant scalar degree of freedom. I'm going to take that to be zeta, the co-moving curvature perturbation, you know, for the usual reason that it's conserved on superhorizon scales. So all the remaining metric perturbation variables just flow from the Einstein constraint equations. Okay, so the idea is that, you know, the idea of inflation is that cosmological perturbations originate as quantum fluctuations on subhorizon scales, and then they're stretched out by an expansion of spacetime. So you go ahead, you work out the two-point functions in the usual manner. You know, inflationary two-point functions are given by the mod squared of the mode functions. So these zeta q and gamma q are the usual inflationary mode functions that appear in the mode decomposition of a quantum field. So if you want to work out the power spectra inflation, then you simply, the power spectra at late times are just given by the late time values of the mode functions. So at early times, the mode functions are given by the Bunch-Davis vacuum. The mode functions obey the classical evolution equations out to late time, and the power spectra at late time are given by the mod squared of the mode functions at late time. So this is just a standard story. Okay, when we come to do holography, it's going to be convenient for us to reformulate this standard story in terms of these quantities, which I'm calling response functions. So there are two response functions, there's omega and there's e, and they relate the canonical momentum to the fluctuation itself. So given a solution, we've got Bunch-Davis vacuum conditions at early times, that selects a solution. Given this solution, we can compute these response functions that relate the canonical momentum to the fluctuation. Now, the point is you can show that the mod squared of the mode functions at late times is given by the imaginary part of these response functions. So this is useful because remember the power spectrum are given by the late time values of the mode functions. So you can re-express the power spectrum in terms of the late time values of these response functions. So this is going to be useful because these same response functions are going to appear in my holographic story. And if you want to understand correlation functions in the dual quantum field theory, you can express those correlation functions in terms of these response functions. So this reformulation is going to be useful for me to make the connection with the dual quantum field theory. To get these relations here at a technical level, you just use the Wronskian relations. You know that your quantum fields obey the standard canonical commutation relations. That gives you Wronskian relations for the mode functions. So that's where these relations here come from. Okay, so now I'd like to tell you about how we connect cosmological spacetimes to these new spacetimes called domain walls. So domain wall spacetimes are very closely related to cosmological spacetimes. The metric is here. So this eta is just a sign. When eta is minus 1, z is a time coordinate, it's proper time, and this is a cosmological background metric. When eta is plus 1, you have what I call a Euclidean domain wall solution. So let me point out, first of all, domain wall is a slightly unfortunate piece of terminology. There is no actual domain wall. It dates from earlier work in the high-energy literature where you had basically two copies of this type of space-time, and then there really was a domain wall. In the present case, there is no domain wall. The name is simply inherited from previous work. So it's a slight misnomer. I apologize for that, but I'm stuck with it. So we have this Euclidean domain wall solution when eta is plus 1. When eta is minus 1, you just have a cosmological solution. So domain wall solutions are very important in holography. They describe holographic renormalization group flows. So in a nutshell, the idea, if you think of your domain wall spacetime, you've got radial evolution. Z is a radius coordinate in the domain wall spacetime. So you've got radial evolution of all your variables in the bulk. And this corresponds to renormalization group flow in the dual quantum field theory. So that's where the name holographic RG flow comes from. You should think of your domain wall spacetime as describing a renormalization group flow in the dual quantum field theory. And the domain wall action is very similar to the cosmological action. I've just flipped a few signs because it's now Euclidean. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to map solutions of the cosmological spacetime, including perturbations, to solutions of the domain wall spacetime, also including perturbations. So the way we go about this is as follows. First of all, we just write down the equations of motion for both domain walls and cosmologies. So the top line, these are just the equations of motion of the background space-time. So to the cosmologist, they probably look slightly unfamiliar, but I promise you they're actually just the standard Friedmann equations in the regime where the evolution of the scalar field is monotonic. So I'm interested in describing holographic RG flows. RG flow is monotonic. That's why I'm working this regime where the scalar field evolution is monotonic. And with that assumption, you can reformulate Friedmann's equations in terms of a first-order set of equations of motion, which are these top ones here. And the bottom line describes the equations of motion of the perturbations. You know, you've got the scalar equation of motion, and you've also got the equation of motion for the tensors. Dots are always differentiated with respect to this variable z that can be either a time or a radius. Okay, so these are the equations of motion. Where does this variable eta appear? So if eta is plus 1, it's a domain wall. If eta is minus 1, it's a cosmology. So if you look at the equations, eta appears only in this term here, multiplying kappa squared v. Remember, kappa squared is 8 pi g Newton. And it also appears here and here, multiplying q squared. Q is the co-moving momentum in the spatial directions. Okay, so if we introduce analytically continued variables, so my notation is that kappa bar is going to correspond to the domain wall solution, as is q bar. So bar means refers to the domain wall. Let's say you start off with a cosmological solution written in terms of kappa and q. If you do this analytic continuation, then you end up with a domain wall solution written in terms of kappa bar and q bar. So it's as simple as that. You just take a cosmological solution in terms of kappa and q, you continue like this, and you end up with a domain wall solution in terms of kappa bar and q bar. So we can map a cosmological solution of the perturbed equations of motion onto domain wall solutions. So a few sure. So this is the point I'm just about to make, in fact. So the point is, this continuation isn't necessarily unique. The principle we use to fix the continuation uniquely is that the continuation of bulk variables should have a clear interpretation when it comes to Q of T language. So in particular, I don't continue T as IR. I don't continue the time coordinate to a radius coordinate, because the dual quantum field theory lives in one dimension less, and it doesn't see the radius coordinate or the time coordinate. So by continuing kappa squared, this we'll see later on that this has a very clear and precise interpretation in terms of the dual Q of T language. Similarly, you could have continued v to minus v, but again, this doesn't have a clear interpretation in terms of dual Q of T language. So I've chosen this particular set of continuations here because it has a very clean interpretation when it comes to dual quantum field theory language, as we'll see later on in the talk. So the set... Sure. That's correct. Yeah, so right. So far, for everything I do in this talk, I'm going to work in the regime where there are no loop corrections in the bulk, so just classical equations of motion in the bulk. And this corresponds to the large n limits in the dual QFT. So you could, an extension of this work would be to consider loop corrections in inflation. This would correspond to looking at one on n corrections in the dual quantum field theory.
But you expect? I think it wouldn't work.
Okay, I haven't looked at this at all. I see no reason why it shouldn't work, but this is something that one should check when one goes to do the computation. I can't see any reason why it wouldn't work, but certainly it's something to be investigated. Yeah. Okay, so the second point is, why did I choose the sign of the continuation here? You know, all I had to do was flip the sign of q squared. Why did I choose it to be minus iq rather than plus iq? So the reason is that in cosmology, at early times, modes in the Bunch-Davis vacuum. I'm going to assume modes in the Bunch-Davis vacuum for simplicity. So at early times, the cosmological modes behave like this, where tau is the conformal time. Now, in holography, you want modes to be regular in the interior of the domain wall space-time. So the sign of the continuation I chose maps the Bunch-Davis vacuum onto these solutions that are exponentially decaying in the interior of the domain wall. So the interior of the domain wall is where this coordinate tau goes to minus infinity. So by choosing this sign here rather than plus iq, I've mapped Bunch-Davis vacuum onto the exponentially decaying solution in the interior of the domain wall. And that solution is a regular one, so that's the correct boundary conditions for holography in the interior of the space-time. Okay, and the third point I wish to make is that one can define response functions for the domain wall space-time. I'm going to call those omega bar and e bar. You know, the bar always refers to domain wall space time. So you can define response functions to the domain wall space time in the analogous fashion to how we did for the cosmology. And the domain wall response functions are related to the cosmological response functions just by these relations here. Again, just analytic continuation. Okay. So now I've started off with cosmology. I've shown you how to reformulate the cosmological power spectrum in terms of these response functions. I've explained how we can do an analytic continuation from cosmological spacetimes to these domain wall spacetimes that describe holographic RG flows. I'd like to tell you now about the class of cosmological solutions and domain wall solutions we're interested in. So basically, there are two classes of domain wall spacetimes where we have a clear holographic interpretation. The first is, of course, the most familiar. That's domain wall spacetimes that are asymptotically anti-de Sitter. So as this radial coordinate z becomes large, then, of course, you just have a scale factor going as e to the z. So these describe quantum field theories that flow to a conformal field theory in the ultraviolet. And under the domain wall cosmology correspondence, these are mapped to cosmologies that are asymptotically de Sitter towards the end of the inflationary era. The second class of domain wall spacetimes, where all of this setup works, is domain walls that are asymptotically power law. So asymptotically, the scale factor goes as this radial coordinate to some power n. N is just a constant. So these how to do holography for these backgrounds has been understood only much more recently in this paper and related papers by Skenderis, Kanitschaider, and Taylor. So in a sense, the trick is that basically you can go to a different conformal frame. And in this dual conformal frame, you find that the metric actually becomes asymptotically anti-de Sitter. So then you can set up your holography story more or less along the same lines as you usually do. So the point is that solutions that are asymptotically power law, these describe quantum field theories that have a single dimensional coupling in the regime where the dimensionality of the coupling constant drives the RG flow. So the point is, under the domain wall cosmology correspondence, these asymptotically power law solutions become obviously asymptotically power law cosmologies. So, you know, in inflation, you're quite used to this solution as being power law inflation, right? So what I'm saying is that we can do this holographic story. Everything is understood for these two classes of cosmologies. Cosmologies that are asymptotically de Sitter at late times, and cosmologies that asymptote at late times to this power law scaling solution here. And the former corresponds to QFTs that flow to a CFT, and the other describe QFTs that have a single dimensional coupling constant. So for example, Jiang Mills. Okay, so let me just describe now standard holography. So the dictionary we're going to create between cosmology and the dual quantum field theory is just going to be based on the standard holographic dictionary. So since this is a mostly cosmological audience, I'd just like to give you a brief overview of the standard holography. So the basic idea is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between local gauge invariant operators in your boundary quantum field theory and the supergravity modes in the bulk. So for example, the bulk metric, this corresponds to the stress tension in the dual quantum field theory. And scalar fields in the bulk, they correspond to some dual scalar operator in the boundary QFT, such as, for example, trace F squared. So the way it works is you can read off correlation functions in the dual quantum field theory from the asymptotic behavior of the bulk fields. And you can also use the correspondence the other way. If you know the correlation functions in the dual quantum field theory, you can reconstruct the asymptotic solution of the bulk fields. So asymptotically meaning at large z, you know, as you go towards the boundary, large radii. So let's see how this works a little bit more precisely. So let's focus on the metric. Remember, the metric is dual to the stress tensor. So if you've got an asymptotically anti-de Sitter solution in four dimensions, you can radiate, there's a solution for the metric. There's a near boundary expansion of the metric that takes this form here. So this is the Pfefferman-Graham expansion. Even in the case of asymptotically power law spacetimes, if you go to this dual conformal frame, you again find that you have this asymptotic expansion of the metric. So this is an expansion starting out at large R and moving inwards. So this just comes from plugging in this ansatz into Einstein's equations and solving order by order. So basically, you can think of this as a sort of power series expansion. There are two undetermined coefficients in this expansion. The first one here, G naught ij, this is arbitrary. And this one here, G2 sigma ij, this is another undetermined coefficient in the asymptotic expansion. So this guy here, so if you look at the leading behavior of the metric, as you go to large R, this is the leading behavior here. It goes as e to the 2r g naught ij. So g naught ij, this is the leading behavior. This describes, so this is the metric on which the dual quantum field theory lives. And it also plays the role of the source of the stress tensor in the dual quantum field theory. So these subleading coefficients here, these are just fixed in terms of the G naught ij by the Einstein equations. And this guy here, this is undetermined. Well, there are some constraints on this G2 sigma ij from the Einstein equations. There are constraints on its trace and on its divergence. But otherwise, this is unconstrained by the asymptotic analysis of the equations of motion. And this subleading coefficient here is, in fact, related to the one-point function of the stress tensor in the dual quantum field theory. It's given by this relationship here. So if you're talking about asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, then 2 sigma is just 3. If you're talking about power law spacetimes, asymptotically power law spacetimes, this 2 sigma is just related to n, you know, the power. Okay. So in particular, if you have a bulk solution, it's got to be regular in the interior. And so from a bulk solution, you can read off G naught, you can read off G2 sigma. And in general, these two wouldn't be related, but the fact you've got regularity in the interior, that's what fixes G2 sigma in terms of G naught. Okay, so the point is, from the bulk asymptotics, we can read off this dual one-point function. Alternatively, given this dual one-point function, we can reconstruct the bulk metric. So the point is that this remains true, even in this new regime where gravity is strongly coupled. So when gravity is strongly coupled, the description in terms of low-energy fields, such as the metric and the inflaton, breaks down deep in the interior of the domain wall spacetime. So essentially, we're considering cosmologies where the metric description breaks down at very early times. But the point is, even when this is true, you still have this asymptotic expansion of the geometry here. And the statement of gauge gravity duality, the statement of the holographic correspondence, is that this subleading term here can be reconstructed using the one-point function of the QFT at weak coupling. So even in this limit where gravity behaves stringy deep in the interior of the domain wall spacetime, even in situations where cosmology is stringy at very, very early times, at late times you have this asymptotic metric description still emerges, and you can fix this asymptotic metric expansion using the one-point function of the dual QFT. So this is essentially what we're going to be doing later. This is how it's going to work. You know, we don't, at very early times, the metric description breaks down, but at late times, towards the end of inflation, you still have this asymptotic geometry, and you can completely fix that asymptotic geometry using the dual quantum field theory. Again, we'll see more precisely how this works in a second.
Apparently.
Yep. Logarithmic. That's correct. Yeah, so basically, yes. Yeah. So the question is that, so here we're working four bulk dimensions. If you have an odd number of bulk dimensions, then this expansion can, this expansion has a logarithmic terms in it, and these are related to the conformal anomaly. So, you know, for a four-dimensional bulk, the boundary is three-dimensional. There's no conformal anomaly. So life is simple for the real world. If you wish to consider high-dimensional cosmologies, you know, the boundary QFT would have a conformal anomaly, and that's related to these logarithmic terms. But, you know, it's all understood. It can certainly be worked out. It's in all the standard holographic literature. It's just that we may as well start off with the real world being four-dimensional until we're forced otherwise. It's a very old-fashioned retro perspective. But okay. Right then, so I want to tell you how to compute two-point functions. In cosmology, we're interested in these power spectra. These correspond to two-point functions. So obviously, in the dual QFT, we're also going to try and compute two-point functions. So standard quantum field theory, right? If you want to work out higher point functions, you take the one-point function and you differentiate with respect to the source, and then you set the source to the background value. So if you want to work out a two-point function, then you differentiate the one-point function. Remember, that was this guy here. You differentiate the one-point function with respect to the source and then set the source to the background value. And the point is that if we're trying to work out two-point functions, we only need to know G2 sigma as a functional of G naught to linear. We only need to know you can think of this guy as a functional of that guy. We only need to know this as a functional of that to linear order. So to compute two-point functions, it's enough just to solve linear perturbations in the bulk geometry. So that makes life easier. Okay, the second point of view is we're going to look at two-point functions for the stress tensor, Tij. In general, just from the look at the Ward identities that this stress tensor obeys, you can show that the two-point function for the stress tensor has this decomposition here. There's a piece A, which is transverse traceless, and there's a piece B, which basically corresponds to the trace. So this big pi ij, this is the transverse traceless projector here. This little pi ij is the usual transverse projector. So this just follows from the Ward identities obeyed by this two-point function here. Okay, So we compute this two-point function here. It's got these two coefficients, A and B. This coefficient A is the transverse traceless piece. Probably you're going to expect that that's going to correspond to the power spectrum for the tensor modes, which are transverse traceless. And unsurprisingly, this B here, which is like the trace piece, this is going to correspond to the scalar power spectrum in cosmology. We're going to see this later. Okay, so I don't want to get too technical in this seminar, but I'd be very happy to discuss the details of what I've done here later. The point is yes. Okay, so I'm working gauge invariant variables, zeta and gamma. So to do...
Why is the second term only involving...
So this dual cube, it lives in three dimensions. Yes.
Yeah, so conservation of T forces it to be proportional to the...
Yes, so you start off with the idea that the one-point function, the divergence of the one-point function is zero. You functionally differentiate with respect to the metric, and then that tells you the two-point function is transverse. So basically, it's got to be transverse, and it's also got to be symmetric under IJKL. So you write down the most general tensor that's transverse and symmetric under IJKL, and it's that one here. I can show it on the board if you like. It's really fun to extend this exercise to the three-point function. Then you'll find it's very hard. So just think of, I want to find something that's transverse in all indices. So it's got to be like little, these are little pi's, ijk, ld. So these are the transverse projection operators, and it's got to act on some tensor, a, b, c, d, some general tensor. So this is the most general object I can write down involving only one momentum that's transverse on all indices. What can this be? It can be made up of momentums and delta functions. It can't contain any momentum because it'll get projected out, so it can only contain delta functions. What terms? There's only three terms involving two delta functions you can write down. You know, delta AB, delta CD, you could write delta AC, delta BD. We have delta AD, delta BC. But you've got to have symmetry under IJKL. You know, if you swap these two guys around, it's got to be symmetric. So if you swap those two with those two, that's a combination, but these two have got to be equal. So basically, you end up with one coefficient here, one coefficient here. Those correspond to the A's and B's there. So for the two-point function, it's quite trivial, this decomposition. What's extremely non-trivial is working on this decomposition, say, for the three-point function, when you go and look at non-Gaussianities. And in that case, it's very, very interesting, very, very difficult, but I have some results, which I'll hopefully tell you at a future date. Okay, so the point is the two-point function has a simple decomposition in terms of two functions, A and B. And that's a completely general statement. So we go away and we work with this radial Hamiltonian formulation to do our holographic analysis. And to cut a long story short, the answer is as follows. So basically, the stress tensor two-point function, these A's and B's, are related to the domain wall response functions. So given the domain wall response functions, you can read off what the two-point functions of the dual quantum field theory is. And these subscripts here are very important. Basically, they tend to take a particular coefficient in the asymptotic expansion of these domain wall spacetimes. I'd be very happy to discuss the details of this later, but I don't want this seminar to become too technical. So at this point, I can just simply quote the results like this. So the point is, given the domain wall response functions, we can extract from them, from their asymptotic behavior, we can extract the two-point functions of this dual quantum field theory. Okay, so let's put it all together. So we started with the cosmology. I showed you how to express the power spectra in terms of these response functions. I showed you how the cosmological response functions map to the domain wall response functions under this analytic continuation. And I showed you how to express the two-point functions of the dual QFT in terms of those domain wall response functions. So I can put it all together now, and I can get a formula relating the cosmological power spectra to the two-point functions of the dual QFT. That's this A and B here. So this is my central result. This formula enables you to get from... So you can start by computing the two-point function in the dual quantum field theory, and it's got this transverse traceless piece and the trace piece, and then you plug it into these formulae, and it gives you the scalar power spectrum and the tensor power spectrum in cosmology. And as you'd probably expect, the transverse traceless piece of the two-point function, the stress tensor, you know, that gives you the tensor power spectrum. So it's fairly intuitive. Okay, so this is my central result. Let's see how I can use this result now.
The
it's a scalar field with a potential.
Okay. guess you do include any interaction.
I include any potential, that's right, yeah. Yes, yeah, so you can look at, say, a massive scalar field or something as a special case if you wish, but no, I'm doing full back reacting the scalar field back, you know, the scalar field mixes with the geometrical fluctuations and arbitrary potential. Yeah, so I'm trying to keep this fairly general.
Okay, but the step that you skipped, which was the autographic normalization.
This part, yes, that's right.
And this was, but that's, so if you have an interacting scalar, do you calculate the normalization with the as a perturbation and the coupling for
this? No. So the point is, you know, so I'm working with arbitrary potential, and if you have a different potential, then this domain wall response function will be different. So, you know, if you change interactions, you're changing the potential, that changes the solutions, that changes this response function here. So this result here is completely general. It works for asymptotically ADS domain walls and for asymptotically power law domain walls. For any V, for any interaction, essentially. Yeah.
What are those functions?
Sorry?
You're not showing us the functions.
E and omega? Yes, that's right. So I simply didn't want to scare people. So these are just the canonical momenta for the perturbation. So, for example, the canonical momentum dual to zeta, the scalar fluctuation, that's just given by 2 epsilon a cubed zeta dot over kappa squared. So kappa was 8 pi g. Epsilon is, remember, it's minus h dot over h squared. A is the scale factor. And similarly for the tensor perturbations, the canonical momenta is, I believe it's just a cubed gamma ij dot over 4 kappa squared. So just the usual canonical momentum. Good. Okay, so we're going to put everything together. So we put the story together, and we've got this relation between the cosmological between the Q of T 2-point functions and the cosmological power spectra. The final piece of this framework that I'd like to describe is how we do this analytic continuation on the quantum field theory side. So we saw that on the gravity side, we flipped Newton's constant and we did this continuation of momentum here. When you translate this into quantum field theory language, obviously, when you translate this into quantum field theory language, obviously the continuation of the momentum is just the same because the momentum appears in both sides of the correspondence. The bulk Newton's constant maps to n squared, where n is the number of colors in the dual quantum field theory. So typically, the quantum field theories that appear in these holographic dualities, they're large n gauge theories, so SUN and n is very large. So basically, Newton's constant in the bulk maps onto n squared, where n is the number of colors in this dual theory. So the idea is that the bulk analytic continuation we chose, translated into quantum field theory language, that amounts to a continuation of n squared and of q. So if you compute any correlator in the quantum field theory, in the large n limit where people do holography, it's going to be some series in 1 on n squared. So basically, 1 on n squared becomes minus 1 on n squared. So you can just compute your correlators in the usual quantum field theory, then you apply these analytic continuations, and that's how you arrive at these correlators of this theory, the pseudo QFT, which is going to be related to cosmology. A technical point, we don't continue the bulk scalar field. Holographically, this maps onto the dimensionful coupling constant in the QFT. So, for example, Jiang-Mills. So we don't continue Jiang-Mills in this setup. Okay. So, Nathan.
Do you think that there is quantum field theory that gives rise to these new correlating functions?
Yeah, okay. So the question is, you know, could we understand this pseudo-quantum field theory with imaginary colors in its own right from first principles? That's something ultimately I'd like to do. I don't know how to do that for now. So for now, all I really understand is how to do an operational picture where we start off with the QFT, compute correlators in a large n limit, and then do the continuation on those correlators. Ultimately, it would be nice to try and understand the pseudo-QFT from first principles. One possibility would be to consider the quantum field theory with complex parameters, and then you know, if you restrict to one real domain, it's a QFT, and another real domain would be the pseudo-QFT. Just like if you think of the bulk description, you know, the metric could be complex, and you know, you take one restriction, you end up with a cosmology, and another domain, you end up with a domain wall. So there may be some sort of picture where you have complex action and so forth, but I don't really know the details of that right now. So, yes, so to be honest, this is something I'd like to understand better. You know, how can you define the pseudo-QFT from first principles with the imaginary number of colors? Does that make sense? But regardless of these much more deeper questions, we can simply work at an operational level. We simply compute correlators and continue correlators. And that's the level at which I'm working for this talk.
So what's wrong with just doing the weak rotation instead of doing this?
Weak rotation of T to IR? Yeah. So the point is that neither the time nor the radial coordinate have a clear interpretation in terms of the dual quantum field theory. So there's a sort of loose sense in which the radial coordinate corresponds to an energy scale in the dual quantum field theory. To make that precise, asymptotically at large radius, the radial derivative maps onto the dilatation operator in the dual quantum field theory. So, but this is only at large radii that this correspondence is exactly true. And continuing the energy in the dual QFT sounds worse. So the idea is that we chose the bulk analytic continuation that has the cleanest interpretation in terms of dual QFT variables. And I believe this is the simplest such continuation you can do. You know, Newton's constant just maps to the number of colors in the dual QFT. So QFT correlators are functions of N and Q, and you just do this continuation here. And you know, the time, the radius coordinates, these aren't seen by the dual quantum field theory. So, you know, it seems more sensible to continue parameters that are seen by both sides of the theory, both sides of the correspondence.
So there are constraints, I believe, that the correlators of the endpoint functions of the theory have to satisfy if the QFT that generates them is unitary.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether if you were continuing colored imaginary colors, you might run about.
Yeah, so I haven't looked at this too precisely. I expect this pseudo-QFT would not be unitary here. Because n squared, n to the up is negative, I would expect it not to be unitary. I would claim that this isn't necessarily a problem. Cosmology isn't unitary. There's no end state, right? You have a big bang. So I haven't studied this in too precise detail, but I would probably expect the pseudo-QFT not to be unitary, and I don't think that's a problem describing cosmology, because there's no S matrix in cosmology. There's no sort of asymptotic end state, so... So yeah, again, these are questions that are worthy of further thought. Yeah. Okay, I'd like to tell you now about the second half of the story. So I've explained how I'm going to try and do holography for cosmology. Now I'd like to tell you what the results are for cosmology. Okay, so in the first part of the story, I went from cosmology to domain-wall space-time to QFT via this top part of the diagram. So this works when the gravity description is weakly coupled. Now I'd like to tell you what happens in the opposite regime when the gravity description is strongly coupled. So to go from the quantum field theory to cosmology, we now go via this lower route here, working in terms of QFT language. So far, all our calculations have been done on the gravity side of the correspondence. But for the early universe, you should really consider the possibility. It's really quite an interesting possibility. No one's looked at this before. What if in the early universe, the gravitational description was strongly coupled? So in that case, all your standard inflationary scenario calculations, these all break down because there's no metric description, for example. But the point is, you can still reconstruct the late-time behavior of the system using the dual quantum field theory at weak coupling.
So there is a slow roll model of inflation, which I think is sort of
classical. I'm not assuming slow roll anywhere today. So
okay.
But anyway, sorry.
Okay, well, in slow roll models, you cannot reach a strong coupling before you have back
connection.
In the sense that the energy and the perturbations is bigger than.
I need to think. Perhaps we should discuss this later. Sure. I'm not quite clear what you mean.
It would be interesting if you could see this also part of field theory that somehow the back reaction.
I mean, I'm doing back reaction in the sense I'm solving full Einstein's equations. I'm not just doing a scalar field on a fixed geometry. I'm including fluctuations of the geometry as well. So I'm doing back reaction in that sense. Perhaps you.
You don't have to have a slow roll.
I'm not assuming slow roll anywhere here. I mean, that's another point I wish to make. But so.
So this is you're gluing this onto a power law inflationary error.
No, this is the power law inflationary error. So the point
so
is.
That's the part that you said that you're going towards a power law.
That's right. And at early times, there's no.
But
metric
early description. Times you don't know what's going to be. At late times, you're gluing it onto a power law.
Precisely, yeah.
So what's driving the power law expansion at late times?
Yeah, so the pitch, well, we still have, so at late times we have this sort of metric description. We still have the scalar field and the potential and
okay,
so forth.
Okay, so you still have scalar field and potential. So now are you slowly rolling?
No, I don't need to be.
But
so
you
could
be.
I could be. Oh, I could be if you wish. Yes, power law includes. Yeah, so basically, basically epsilon is 1 over n. So if n is large, then I think that's right, isn't it? So basically, you could do slow roll if you wish. I don't wish to be restricted
it's
by.
It's not really doing anything. It's just has a model, a 4D model with the scalar potential, which has power law inflation.
Okay.
So right. He's studying that model and trying to study what happens when gravity becomes strong.
Yeah, so the scenario is roughly here. So the idea is that at early times we have this holographic phase where gravity is strongly coupled. And to understand this phase, we use the dual quantum field theory, which is weakly coupled. And then at late times, we're going to get back our standard hot Big Bang cosmology where gravity is weakly coupled. So the idea is that your dual quantum field theory is strongly is weakly coupled in this regime and strongly coupled in the late time regime. So you can think of this as the normalization group flow of the dual quantum field theory. It starts off in the infrared regime at weak coupling, and then in the ultraviolet regime at strong coupling. So I want these two pictures to match smoothly.
And is that matching that I'm asking about? Is how in this matching you're in this late time power law inflation where things are weakly coupled.
That's right.
So my normal understanding of inflation applies.
So how
long does that regime last? Won't that regime just erase all the stuff that you're calculating right now? The stuff that you're calculating right
now? No.
So the
part that was incorrect was the first part about, so you go to this regime where gravity is strongly coupled. There's no metric description at early times, but at late times you have this asymptotic geometry. And that asymptotic geometry is reconstructed using a dual QFT, not Einstein's equations. So Einstein's equations only fix these. Einstein's equations don't determine these two coefficients, G naught and G2 sigma. In order to fix those two undetermined coefficients, you have to use the dual quantum field theory. So the dual QFT is what you use to reconstruct this late time regime here. And then after the end of inflation, then we go over to usual weakly coupled gravity, and then your usual sort of picture would hold. But, you know, it doesn't have to be inflating this regime.
So how are you ending inflation? How do you get out of the power
curve? So, again, this is something that needs further work to make absolutely precise. But the sort of picture I'm imagining is that, so gravity is strongly coupled at early times. We've got a smooth transition to gravity weakly coupled at late times. So that in a dual language, this corresponds to a QFT that is weakly coupled in the infrared and ends up strongly coupled in the ultraviolet. And I want a smooth transition between the two. So you should think of this as holographic normalization, as RG flow, basically. So this isn't something that I have a very precise formulation of, but I want this scenario where gravity is strongly coupled at early times, and that's when you generate the perturbations in this asymptotic region here, which I can reconstruct using holography. And then you just smoothly match on to some sort of late time description where ordinary gravity is valid. And you should think of this whole thing as like RG flow in the dual QFT.
But it's not a trivial problem to go to from the regime of strong coupling to the regime of weak coupling. It's not a,
I don't see
not
why
a difficult problem. It is a difficult problem.
Is it? Why? I mean, it's just RG flow.
In the QFT,
it's just RG. Yes, but it's just RG flow. So the point is,
we still can't.
I'm not sure.
I mean, in principle,
what do you mean? I mean, so we've got this weakly coupled QFT. You can compute the beta function. You've got RG flow. I mean,
yeah,
of course, when the QFT becomes
correlators into the
no, I don't need to. So the point is, I just need to compute the correlators here towards the end of inflation error using strongly coupled gravity, which is weakly coupled QFT.
The only problem is that either the field theory is perturbative or the gravity is perturbative.
That's right.
They're never simultaneously valid.
But the point is, I don't need Einstein. So the point is, I don't need.
Once you get the bulk correlators, you will need to use the Einstein equation.
So the point is, using the dual QFT, I can reconstruct the metric here asymptotically using only the dual QFT. And, I just compute the one-point function. I plug it into that asymptotic expansion. It was this, we'll go back to the Pfeffer-McGraham expansion, right? So the point is, using the dual QFT lives on this metric. This is related to the one-point function of dual QFT. These are the only undetermined coefficients in this asymptotic expansion. So the point is that strongly coupled gravity, string dynamics in the interior, whatever, that will tell you what this is. But the whole point of the holographic correspondence is that you can also fix this coefficient here using a dual QFT at weak coupling. So Einstein's equations, they just tell you you've got this asymptotic expansion like this. They don't tell you what these two coefficients are. To work out those coefficients, you have to use the dual QFT at weak coupling.
Well, if you're right about that, then the time dependence of your correlators has to be their time should agree perfectly with the weakly coupled gravity description.
I mean, at late times they go to a constant, don't they? I mean, zeta goes to a constant at late time, so does gamma ij. So, in cosmology, right? Yes.
But so the point, like a particular form, and that form should agree with the weak gravitational coupling.
But you can calculate it at late times because the quantum field theory becomes a standard coupling, so you don't.
So the point is that the super horizon power spectra is constant, like the mode functions go to a constant at late times.
Yeah, but they go in a particular way to a constant.
That's true, but the point is the sub-leading behavior is what's related to the two-point functions, right? So the point, which I'm fixing using a dual Couturier weak coupling. So zeta at late times, it goes to a constant and there's a sub-leading mode that decays away as some behavior. So the way the sub-leading mode decays, that's captured in these response functions, which are fitted by the two-point function of the dual QFT. So the behavior of this strong gravity regime is determined fully by the dual QFT, and it doesn't come from, usual...
Well, okay, so there are two possibilities. Either that time dependence agrees with standard inflationary coupling.
But if it did that, then you would never get anything new.
That's right.
So the point is I'm getting new predictions that disagree with standard inflation.
So then there are two possibilities. One is that standard inflation is incorrect. Okay.
No. I would rather say that I have a model with a single parameter coupling. When this coupling is strong, then ordinary weakly coupled gravity's value, you get back standard inflation. In the other limit, when this coupling is weak, you get new predictions that are qualitatively different from inflation that I'll describe in just a second. So I'd say this is a class of models that generalize inflation. In the strong coupling QFT regime, you've got standard inflation, but it also generalizes it to this new regime where gravity is strongly coupled at early times. The dynamics are fixed by the dual QFT, and that really is different to standard inflation. And I'll be able to show you predictions that differ. To convince people.
So, but the problem Adrian's having is that I think I'm saying it right is that there should be an intermediate region of time.
What if this power law make time
region continued after?
Yeah. What if the last 60 e-folds were all there? How would I see any?
Yeah. So that's right. So I don't want to have that. Yes, because if that happened, then obviously you just get back standard inflation, which
that's
I don't want.
Question. Okay,
so my point is.
Yeah,
so basically,
the asymptotic region doesn't last too long.
The idea is that, so let's say reheating is this surface here. So the idea is that anything prior, the whole of the inflation regime is described by strongly coupled gravity and using the dual QFT. And then at the end of inflation, then we match on to this weakly coupled gravity description.
Because
So the point is the power law describes the asymptotic geometry towards the end of this holographic phase, and this power law asymptotic isn't controlled.
So
the power law is present in a strongly coupled gravity. The point is so you've got strongly coupled gravity, right? No metric description at early times, but the asymptotic geometry is controlled by this power law solution. Mm-hmm. And you can fully fix this asymptotic geometry using the dual QFT at weak coupling. And then, so this is producing perturbations, and now I want inflation to end and just go to the non-inflating ordinary hot Big Bang cosmology. So the perturbations are going to be those produced by this strongly coupled gravity regime. You're correct that if we ended the holographic phase and went on to an ordinary inflation phase afterwards, then we just wipe everything out. And there'd be no point in doing that. Of course, you could, but you wouldn't get anything different. So I want to get something different. So I want the holographic phase to describe all the way to the end of inflation, and I'm just going to reconstruct the classical metric geometry just before the end of inflation using the dual QFT language. And we're going to see how we get different predictions.
I have a question about an original NDS CFT. So if you think about the bulk gravity, one of the equations controlling the many bulk is the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes, that's correct.
And this Hamiltonian constraint becomes asymptotically the conformal world.
Correct. Yep.
So the fact that your QFT is a CFT is essentially the signature that comes from gravity.
I mean, our QFT is not a CFT.
Yeah,
but
your QFT is not a CFT. So what replaces the expression of the Hamiltonian constraint?
Oh, you still have a trace Ward identity, even though it's so it's described.
So where is the constraint?
Yeah, so it's described in those papers with Kanat, Scheider, Skenderis, and Taylor in more detail. Basically, you have this generalized conformal symmetry where the coupling constant also transforms under a conformal transformation. And so from this, what they call a generalized conformal symmetry, you have a generalized trace ward identity, and that corresponds to the Hamiltonian constraint in the bond.
Okay, so that's the answer to your question. The fact that it's not any QFT, but you know, the one that, so you haven't shown this extra condition that you're supposed to satisfy. So there's some extra condition that you're supposed to satisfy that implies that you're coming from the gravity.
I'm not sure I agree. So in the bulk, you've got the Hamiltonian momentum constraints. These map onto the trace and the diffeomorphism ward identities in the dual theory. This holds whether you're doing asymptotically parallel or asymptotically ADS. Obviously, the precise form of these ward identities depends on the asymptotics. But that's right. But this is all done in this Hamiltonian holographic formulation. It's all in the papers. So.
But these are the
I don't understand the connection. So
maybe you can answer that connection. So it's basically the scalar field corresponding to the chain.
Yes, that's right. So the asymptotic value of the bulk scalar field ends up as basically the Yang-Mills coupling.
So can you reinterpret this condition as a particular condition on symmetry satisfied by the scalar field?
So but I don't think these are conditions. The point is the bulk theory, you've got these, you've got the constraint equations, and these constraint equations on the gravity side, they map to the ward identities which constrain your QFT correlators.
So
these are always true.
What is the ward identity? Condition on
trace of T. Yeah, so for example, if you took the asymptotic ADS case, then the trace ward identity tells you the one-point function for T and the beta function times a one-point function for the dual scalar operator equals zero. And if you go to the asymptotic parallel case, you get a slightly different trace ward identity.
So you use that in
no. Well, no. Okay. So in the holographic. So again, this is I think we're losing. No. So the point is to get these formula here on the bulk side, I had to make use of the constraint equations. So. You know, the constraint equations do appear in computing these formulae here. I mean, if you want to, where the ward identities come in is that so if you wanted to compute using different variables in the bulk, you know, things like Mukhanov R rather than zeta, then that would correspond to working out the two-point function for the dual scalar operator. And so you can get, you know, in the bulk side, you can get between different fluctuation variables using gauge transformations. In the dual QFT, you can get between different variables using the dual ward identities. But I would claim that this is all rigorously built into the Hamiltonian holographic framework. And you know, I simply don't need to discuss it in this present context because I haven't used it explicitly. But all of this, this formalism, you know, this is really one of the whole points of this radial Hamiltonian formulation. The ward identities are perfectly encoded. You know, they hold exactly, and they correspond to the constraint equations in the bulk spacetime. So all of this is one of the key features of this Hamiltonian holographic normalization formulation. I'd be happy to discuss this in more detail later. It's simply, for the present talk, I only need these results.
Sorry, let me try again. So,
yep, sorry. So yes, I didn't understand the connection.
So basically, if I think of my normal inflation equation, I think I have some good properties of any scalar field in order to get inflation out of that.
Yes, that's great.
And that symmetry carries over into properties of the here,
yep.
You have the same kind of system where you somehow are relating. You're getting properties of the stress energy constant in the scalar field related to these identities from the gravity side.
Yes, although you'll see there's a twist on that story when we come to parallel spacetimes.
Okay, but I guess, can I reinterpret some of these constraints as similar to the symmetries of the scalar field that give me inflation to begin with?
I don't think so, because the Hamiltonian momentum constraints hold for any solution. They don't depend on, you know, I mean, the Hamiltonian momentum constraints in GR always hold. They don't care whether you're talking about a de Sitter inflation or a black hole or any solution.
Yeah. No, so
the properties of the fluctuation spectrum are determined entirely by the geometry. They aren't determined by the constraint equation. Because the constraint equations hold for any solution. Holography works for any solution with the correct asymptotics. So the constraint equations don't fix the fluctuation spectrum. They fix these ward identities that it must obey.
But there are particular properties of fluctuation spectra that only come during inflation, which must be somehow properties of the fact that you're
using these. Yes, so I think what you're saying is that if we're talking about, say, asymptotically de Sitter inflation, you know, the de Sitter isometries mean you've got particular properties for your power spectrum cosmology, and in the dual quantum field theory, you know, this de Sitter isometry maps on the fact that it's asymptotically a conformal field theory, so you've got the conformal symmetry. So the idea is the de Sitter isometries map onto the conformal symmetry of the dual QFT. So in that case, it's not surprising that the symmetries in the QFT are what controls the behavior of the correlators. But the case I want to talk about, we're going to get something rather different, and that's actually quite interesting. So perhaps I'd like to... Yes, we're going to run out of time.
Yeah, you have some approximate...
Yeah, so I'd like to move on at this point. Okay, so I'd like to talk about my results, and we can come back to discuss details of holographic normalization later, because they're all details. So the point is, you know, what is this dual QFT array? So it's going to be some large engaged theory. It's going to have general matter content. You're allowed to have scalar fields, fermions, and so forth, and you're going to have a large N expansion. So my strategy is we're going to perturbatively compute this two-point function, and we're going to plug it into our holographic formula to compute the power spectrum of cosmology, and then we're going to face the music. We're going to see how it compares with the actual data. So let me just remind you very briefly, obviously the power spectrum can be parameterized in this standard form here. We have the amplitude of the power spectra, and we have the spectral index, Q is the co-moving momentum. From the data for the scalar power spectrum, we know two things. Principally, we know there are two small numbers, all right? The scalar power spectrum is small amplitude, and it's nearly scale invariant. Okay, so the experimental data has these two small numbers, the small amplitude and nearly scale invariant. These two small numbers have to appear naturally in any sort of dual quantum field theory that explains the data. And we're going to see how that works. So as a starting point, let's consider the strongly coupled gravity version. Well, the dual QFTs you could think of, they'd be the strongly coupled gravity versions of the asymptotically de Sitter cosmologies and asymptotically power law cosmologies. I'd love to look at the different case. I'd like to look at cosmologies that are asymptotically power law, because these are not CFTs. These are QFTs with a single dimensional coupling constant. So I'm going to look at asymptotically power law cosmologies. These correspond to supernormalizable QFTs with a single dimensional coupling, Jiang-Mills. And as a prototype theory, I'm just going to say three-dimensional SUN Yang-Mills theory with arbitrary matter, with some random matter content. So basically adjoint fermions, adjoint scalars.
Can I ask you, what are the Waldheim?
You may write these things down.
Is the satisfied the correspondence?
Yes, so you have this, basically you have this generalized conformal symmetry where Jiang-Mills also transforms under conformal transformations. The Ward identity, the trace Ward identities, may be found in that paper by Kanachida, Skinderis, and Taylor. I will show you explicitly what this is afterwards. It's not important for today's story.
Can I think of it as some kind of nearly scaling running theory?
No, it's not. The RG flow is determined by the dimensionality of the coupling constant. So this is not a CFT, right? It's a QFT with a single dimensional coupling. So I would like to get through this story, so perhaps, if you don't mind, we could continue later. Okay, so let's compute this two-point function, right, for the stress tensor. So the leading computation, the leading order computation is this one-loop computation here. Now, you don't even need to do all the detailed calculations. You can see the answer just on dimensional grounds. So the point is, Jiang-Mills doesn't appear in this computation to leading order, so the only dimensional parameter you have is the momentum. The stress tensor in dimension 3 has dimension 3. So you can see already, just on dimensional grounds, that the two-point function goes as momentum cubed. All right, just on dimensional grounds, because there's no Jiang-Mills appearing, so the only dimensional parameter is momentum. It's got to be momentum cubed, so this is the only way, this is how it has to go. And the factor of n squared, just because you've got n squared degrees running around the loop. If you like, you can go away. So I went away and I did the one-loop integrals, and you find that these coefficients, these proportionality coefficients here, these are dependent on the matter content. So this is the number of gauge fields, this is the number of minimally coupled scalars, this is the number of conformally coupled scalars, this is the number of fermions. So depending on the matter content of your theory, that's what determines these proportionality constants here. But the whole point is that the two-point functions are just given by momentum cubed, and it goes n squared, because that's the loop.
So that's the n bar, the negative n squared?
So this is the moment I'm doing my calculation of the QFT corresponding to the domain wall. So this is n bar corresponding to the domain wall. I'm going to later flip it. So that's right. I'm going to flip it just here. So the point is, you take these results, you plug them into my holographic formula. This is what you get out for the cosmological power spectra. So there are two things you notice straight off. First of all, at leading order, the cosmological power spectra are scale invariant. So this one is Q cubed, but our holographic formula also had a Q cubed in it, and they cancel out. So at leading order, the power spectra are scale invariant. That's prediction one. And that's independent of the matter content. That came out simply on dimensional grounds. You can see that. So this is where it's different, say, for asymptotically de Sitter inflation. Asymptotically de Sitter inflation corresponds to a CFT. They've got conformal symmetry. The conformal symmetry is what determines the scale invariance of the spectrum. Here it comes out because we're working perturbatively in Jiang-Mills, strongly coupled gravity, perturbative in Jiang-Mills, and in this perturbative calculation, you get this Q cubed here, basically because the coupling, the interactions, don't appear at leading order.
So fermions contribute the same signs?
They do, that's right. I'm computing a stress tensor. I'm computing a two-point function of the stress tensor. So that's why. Let me get through this.
I'm impressed that they came out positive.
We will.
That wasn't totally obvious.
No, so
n bar squared goes to minus n.
Oh, yes, that's right. No, so the way it works, so you've got to continue, q bar goes to minus iq, and n squared goes to minus n squared. It's non-trivial, but it works, and this is our point. This thing is non-trivial. Okay, so the second point is that look at the amplitude of the power spectrum, right? That goes 1 over n squared. This is crucial, right? We're working at the power spectrum have amplitude 10 to the minus 9. I'm working in this at Hoeft limits where n is large. All holographic dualities, the classical gravity side corresponds to large n in the gauge theory. So the point is that small amplitude of the scalar power spectrum corresponds to large n. Okay, so that's a crucial consistency check. If that had come out the wrong way around, you'd be dead already. Okay, so the leading calculation, one loop order, you get scalar invariance and you get large n is consistent with small amplitude scalar power spectrum. You can fit the ratio of the tensor to scalar power spectra by tuning the matter content. So basically, the ratio of tensor to scalar power spectra depends on the ratio of these two coefficients. So by adjusting the matter content, you can satisfy any upper bound on tensors. You just need more conformal scalars and massless fermions or fewer gauge fields and minimal scalars. Okay. Obviously, the real scalar power, the real power spectrum is not quite scalar invariant. So to understand these deviations from scalar invariance, we have to go to subleading order in our QFT calculations. So we go where we compute two loop diagrams. And the way it works is that you find these subleading, the two loop, so this is the leading contributions we found before. The two loop calculations give you these subleading contributions here. And it depends on this effective coupling constant, which is g squared n over q. So this effective coupling constant is dimensionless. G squared has mass dimensions, q has mass dimensions. So by looking at the subleading corrections, they give you these contributions here. So basically the deviation from scale invariance, you know, the spectral tilt, is given by this effective coupling constant here. So this is, again, a crucial consistency check, because we know from the data that the scalar power spectrum is very nearly scale invariant, right? Ns minus 1 is of order 10 to the minus 2. So that implies that G effective is of order 10 to the minus 2, which is consistent because we're working in this limit where gravity is strongly coupled and the dual QFT is weakly coupled, G effective is weakly coupled. So that's a second crucial consistency check. If you wish to work out the sign of the spectral tilt, whether it's red or blue, you have to go away and you have to compute all two loop diagrams. This is a massive calculation. This is something I intend to do at some point. But even without doing this calculation, just from the form of the integrals, by doing a few diagrams and looking at the form of the integrals, you can get this result here. If you wish to know these precise coefficients, you have to do all two-loop diagrams. And then you probably find that whether the spectrum is red or blue depends on the matter content. But this would be a very important calculation to do, because then you can look for constraints of n against r. So, you know, how does the spectral tilt go as a function of r, the ratio of tensors to scalars? So,
but it's not at all a tilt, it just goes like 1 over q. So.
Yeah, so this is my next point. So, okay, so as Neil points out, the point is the deviation from scale invariance, this goes as g effective, which is 1 over q. If you differentiate this relationship with respect to momentum, you find running of the scalar industries, running of the spectral indices. So if you look at the scalar spectral index, for example, the running is given by minus the deviation from scale invariance. That just comes from differentiating this formula here. I don't know what this coefficient is. It's of order 1. I don't know what it is. It's model dependent, but it doesn't affect. It drops out when you do the differentiation. So although I don't know exactly what the matter content is, I can constrain it using the data. Regardless of the matter content, I get this predicted running here. And this is qualitatively different to slow roll inflation, right? Slow roll inflation tells you that alpha over ns minus 1 is a first order slow roll. So here's a prediction that is independent of the matter content. It is qualitatively different to slow roll inflation. I claim that it is still, at present, consistent with the WMAP data. So this diagram here is straight out of Komatsu's WMAP data paper. I've adulterated it by adding this straight line here. Okay, so first look at the data. So we've got the running on the vertical axis. We've got the spectral tilt on the bottom axis. The data show the 65 and 98% confidence limits marginalizing over tensors, because we have tensors in our model, so we have to marginalize over tensors. So as the data improve, these allowed regions are going to shrink down to some point. Our prediction is that this point will lie on this line here. So this line is alpha is minus the deviation from scale invariance. That represents the predictions of these holographic models. We have a single-dimensional coupling constant. So regardless of the details of the matter content, I get this hard prediction that the running is minus the deviation from scale invariance. That's this line here. It appears to be consistent with the experimental data so far. We'll have to see how this bears up under further experimental improvement. Okay, so just to round off the story, the other great thing we're going to look at is non-Gaussianities, right? There's a lot more information in non-Gaussianities than there are in the simple power spectrum. So this is currently a project that's underway. It's extremely difficult and challenging technically, but we're nailing it. So we're going to get a very strong test of these holographic models. There's a lot of information here. You know, observationally, this man is sitting out here at the Lagrange point mapping the microwave sky into unprecedented detail. Hopefully we're going to have very strong experimental data. Well, hopefully we're going to have experimental data on non-Gaussianities in the very near future. And, you know, once we fix the parameters of our holographic model, we fix N using the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum, we fix Gyang-Mills using the spectral tilt, you know, given the field content, then all the predictions are fixed and they just follow from computation. I don't want to say too much at this point, but basically, at the moment, it's looking like FNL is basically independent of N in the large N limit. So in the large N limit, you know, you've got this expansion in powers of 1 over N. If you found that FNL went to some positive power of N, you'd be dead in the water because N is 10 to the 4. If it went to some inverse power of N, you'd probably never see it. What we're finding so far is that it's of order 1 in the 1 on N expansion. The momentum dependence I'm still working on. So non-Gaussianities will hopefully be a very exciting thing to talk about in a couple of months. Okay, so let me just summarize. So I've shown you how you can describe standard inflationary cosmology in terms of a three-dimensional quantum field theory without gravity. And this correspondence, all your results of standard inflationary scenarios are incorporated in this holographic picture when the dual QFT are strongly coupled. What I think is so interesting about holography is using it in the opposite regime. You want to understand the situation where gravity is strongly coupled at early times, and this you can make predictions for using the dual QFT at weak coupling. So I've shown you how to make calculations for the QFT at weak coupling and obtain predictions from the cosmological power spectra. And I've shown that it's simple to find models that fit the data using QFTs with a single dimensional coupling constant. And everything has come out very nicely so far. The small amplitude of the scalar power spectrum maps to large N. The near scale invariance of the power spectrum maps to Gyang, you know, the effective coupling constant being small, which is this strongly coupled gravity regime I'm looking at. We get this unique prediction for things like the running that are independent of matter content. Also, we've got this very, very simple mechanism for getting a near scale invariant spectrum, essentially on dimensional grounds. And again, that was independent of the matter content. So looking to the future, hopefully, in a couple of years, we're going to have some very tight data on things like non-Gaussianities and also further constraints on, for example, the running. So in addition to the theoretical evidence we already have for holography, it's not inconceivable that in a couple of years we might soon have the first observational evidence for the holographic nature of our universe. Thank you.
So if you believe in this model is SUN, where N is 10 to the 4th, roughly.
Yep.
And what constrains the matter? Like, there was that ratio constrained the matter content, but is there any other way of constraining it?
Yeah, so there's a couple of constraints on the matter content. So, for example, the upper bounds. We've got an upper bound experimentally on the ratio of the gravity power spectrum to the scalar power spectrum. So there's this variable R. So that depends on the matter content of the theory. So this places one constraint. A second constraint will come from the spectral index, whether it's red tilted or blue tilted spectrum. Again, that requires working out
what that DB is.
No, because to do that requires summing up all two loop graphs. There are a large number of classes of these. It's a large number of integrals. It's very hard work. It will take quite a number. This is something that should definitely be done, and I wish to do this, but it may take a.
So, as a naive question, you chose a particular SUN model in 3D. I could imagine choosing.
I tried to write down the most.
UN cross UN, or all kinds of other different routes.
So, I tried to write. That's correct, yeah. So,
other predictions.
That's right. So basically all the holographic gauge theories we know are these SUN ones, because these correspond to the sort of low-energy effect theories of D-brains. So, I mean, basically all the sort of holographic dualities people have studied so far are sort of SUN, large N, Yang-Mills theories. And then the strategy for choosing the matter content, I simply wish to write down the most. So I'm doing phenomenology here. I just want to write down the most general possible theory you can imagine. So I've got various gauge fields, minimally and conformally coupled scalars. I've got fermions. And I've got some sort of generic interactions here. The point is the interactions don't affect the leading order calculation, which is all that I've done so far. If you wish to work out the two-loop, you know, if you wish to do these calculations, this is where the interactions come in.
Oh, I understand that, yeah. But you could have, I mean, at this level.
So you could have changed the gauge group, that's true.
That's what I mean. I can change the gauge group. Could be.
Yeah, so you could have done UN or something. Yeah, that's right. I suppose the point is just that, you know, these things are meant to Yeah, so you know, how do you write down this dual QFT? What are your guidelines? The idea is that the holographic dualities we understand so far correspond to bulks that are asymptotically de Sitter and asymptotically parallel, and these correspond to dual gauge theories that are basically sort of SUN type.
Well, I know that's
theories.
What they do, but at this level you don't require it. I mean, so what
the simplest thing I can
imagine is U1 to the M. Is that viable?
Probably not, but I
probably.
I doubt, well, no one's got any sort of holographic example of that form, as I understand.
But just, you do the calculation with this group and you
yeah.
try
so, it. I mean, at this level, it's hard to restrain. I suppose the point is just that you've got to start somewhere with what, you know, ultimately you'd like to have some string or M-theory construction to tell you what this dual theory is precisely. In the absence of that, I'm going to try and take a phenomenological approach. I want to start with something that's as close as possible to the holographic dualities we understand so far. All the holographic dualities we understand so far involve basically SUN, large N-gauge theories. So, you know, this seems to be a reasonable starting point, and I try to make the matter content I've added as general as possible.
No, I don't object to that, but it just seems to me at this level, if you want to use cosmology to constrain this, I'd be rather surprised if it uniquely constrained that. I could imagine all kinds of...
Yes, I mean, of course it doesn't uniquely...
Grangians that could give you...
Well, it has to admit a large N expansion as well as another thing, so the form of these interactions...
You want the N. Just lots of
new ones. Yes, potentially it could, yes. I mean, you know, we'll have to go and look at that. So it's going to be some large N-gauge theory. All the examples we know
so far of this class.
And basically the interaction terms are also constrained by admitting large N limits as well. But, yeah, the approach is simply to use the data to try and constrain what the matter content, for example, is. And the surprise is that some cosmological predictions are independent of the matter content. So, for example, scale invariance at BD order is independent of the matter content, and this prediction about the running is independent of the matter content. You know, they just depend on the fact that this QFT has a single-dimensional coupling. So I agree. At the level of phenomenology, there are perhaps more general things you can write down, but we're trying to start as close to the holographic dualities we understand as possible.
Going back to the earlier question.
Yeah.
So just the fact that you say you're making the measurement of NS is relevant to this dual picture.
Yeah.
Just the value of Q not for you gives you an upper bound on the
Yeah. So for example, this Q naught that appears, Q naught basically corresponds to the normalization group scale in the QFT. So when you do your QFT calculation, you get these logarithms, and the logarithms are cut off by this, you know, RG scale in the QFT. And basically, this RG scale in the QFT corresponds to the pivot scale used in cosmology.
Right. So that's making a measurement around that.
So,
you make
so, so, so
your
I,
picture,
yeah.
You don't want it to correspond to whatever information is giving you the end of the information or the information is giving you. You want that to give you an upper bound on the length of high information.
I do. I'm not sure any of that makes sense because I'm working in this regime where gravity is strongly coupled. You're saying, you know, how long does this asymptotic classical metric description last for? You know, I think you should throw away your... The whole point is we're getting predictions that are qualitatively different to standard slow inflation. You should throw away, you know, your classical intuition about these things, because we're doing all this from the weakly coupled QFT, and, you know, I'm not sure it makes sense to say sort of, you know, how long,
yeah,
how many e-folds...
Do you have any idea what...
You're making, how long the transition is it? If you're making the transition
but,
from the strong coupled...
Oh, it's instantaneous. So
let
so
me just rephrase the question. Do you know what the scalar, what the model looks like in the weakly coupled gravitational regime? Do you know?
Yes, I'm using that. So I'm doing my calculations in weakly coupled QFT. So
gravitation, weakly coupled gravity.
Yes, I do. It's just parallel inflation, asymptotically parallel inflation.
Yeah, how did you?
So the point is that.
How did you figure out the scalar potential in that regime?
So it's arbitrary. The point is, you just want some scalar potential that leads to an asymptotically power law. Inflationary solution. So basically, you know that exponential potential is what gives you this power law inflationary solution. So you just want some potential such that the geometry is asymptotically power law. They don't need
determine the exponential, the exponent in that exponential.
There will be some variable in the QFT that tells you that n, that exponent.
Yeah. What is that?
Yeah, that's something I'm working on, actually. I should work it out. I haven't worked it out. It'll be something. It's a property of the background solution, so there'll be some property of the background QFT that corresponds to N. It's something I meant to check up, but I haven't actually done. But it should be straightforward to work it out.
But of course, you don't really want that power law to continue forever.
I'm going to end inflation at some point, yeah. So basically, my picture is that...
You want these modes to have exited the Hubble radius during strong decoupling.
Correct, yeah. That's right.
The point
is all this is a very nice interpretation in QFT, it's just RG flow, and you've got this region where the dual QFT is weakly coupled and flows to a strongly coupled region as you go from IR to UV. So I see no problem between matching between these kind of strongly coupled gravity and weakly coupled regions. The whole point is to use, you know, I want to get something different from standard inflation, so I have to use this strongly coupled gravity regime in order to do that.
Oh, yeah,
this is coming back to your point. I mean, there is no standard inflation regime in between. The whole of the inflationary phase is described holographically using strong gravity and weakly coupled QFT. And then you go straight into hot big bang, you know, massive radiation domination and so forth. Yeah, otherwise. Yeah.
You keep saying power law inflation. So power law inflation effect plays no role.
It does. No.
What is the precise role played by power law inflation?
Yeah, good. Okay, so the point is, so all of this works for two classes of asymptotics, asymptotically decitant, asymptotically power law. The asymptotics determines the nature of the dual QFT. If it's asymptotically power law, then it tells you your dual QFT has a single-dimensional coupling constant. Otherwise, asymptotic decitter tells you it's dual to a QFT that flows to a CFT in UV. So that's where...
That power law inflation only tells you about the asymptotics of your...
Of the geometry.
Of the strongly coupled gravity.
Correct, yeah.
So, but you never get there. The real universe never goes to that phase.
No, I'm saying it does. I'm saying so very early times the universe is strongly coupled.
So you say that's the asymptotics, but you cut this off during the strongly coupled regime and go to the hot big bang, right?
I'd like to do it smoothly, but essentially, yes.
Yeah. So, but you never get to the asymptotics.
You do, yeah. Okay. So by asymptotic, I mean towards the end of inflation.
So this is the core question. So at the end of inflation, are you strongly coupled?
Yes,
or not?
I'm strongly coupled.
But it's not really power law inflation.
No, that's our point. Okay. It's a strong coupling version of power law inflation. So the predictions are different. So if you have ordinary power law inflation when gravity is valid, you get different predictions. You don't get a scaling variance spectrum, right? As you know, you only get a scaling variance spectrum as n goes to large, if n becomes large, and you tend towards the sitter. So the point is, yeah, if you work where gravity is weakly coupled and you have ordinary power inflation, you get different predictions to what happens if you do what I'm doing, which is a strongly coupled version of power inflation, where gravity is strongly coupled. And in this one, we get different predictions. We get scalar variance spectrum in the order. So that's right. So the predictions do crucially depend on what the coupling is.
So the point is that in no sense that we're used to is
the
power
off. No, quite. The only sense in which is any similar is that asymptotically the geometry has the same asymptotic power law scaling as ordinary power law inflation. But of course, the predictions are different.
If I took a theory with an exponential potential.
Yes.
And
exact
large,
power law inflation.
Large exponent, e to the minus n.
Yes.
And it's a big number.
Yeah, yeah.
Down here, it looks weakly coupled.
No, you can't say it, because the coupling is independent of what this potential is, the different parameters.
Yeah, so that's what I'm struggling to understand, is that in the gravitational picture, I would say that if you're way down the slope, much less than the plane density, and is big, this is very weakly coupled gravitation.
Yeah.
The only chance of going strong coupling is when you go way up.
I think we're just
so which regime would you describe?
No, you have to look at the holographic.
Does this model include both?
So you have to look at the holographic dictionary. So the point is that, Newton's constant in the bulk maps onto n squared in the dual theory. So basically, if you look at the 1 on n subleading corrections, that corresponds to loop corrections, quantum loop corrections on the bulk side. And this coupling I'm talking about in the dual QFT, this controls whether supergravity approximation is valid in the bulk. So basically, it controls the ratio of the string length to the ADS length. So basically, when I say the dual QFT is weakly coupled, that means the string length and the ADS length aren't widely different. But the supergravity, the usual picture, supergravity approximation is only valid in the limit where the string length is small compared to the bulk ADS length. And that corresponds to the dual or Toft coupling being large. So coupling is meant strictly in this holographic dictionary sense. So, that's different to...
actually have a question related to that. First, so maybe formally, should we
call it quits?
We're over to call it quits.
Yeah.
Fortunately.